Blog Talk Radio.
This is Jasa Sagonige, a seventh great grandson of Sawanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evening and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous, plant-based, native sacraments. Aho. You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Atawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius.
I'm Austin Powers. I like Gas Mojo. The very sexy and very switched on, yeah.
But you gotta have Gas Mojo, baby, yeah!
What a gas, baby, yeah!
I'm going to go back to the 60s and steal Austin Powers' Gas Mojo.
Hi, folks, this is Will Bluewater speaking on behalf of GasMojo.net Engine Booster. Immediate 25% fuel savings with GasMojo.net in just 5 minutes after installation. And your grandma can do it, so you just strap it on your fuel line, folks. Some customers report much greater savings. The GasMojo.net engine booster catalytically conditions any hydrocarbon fuel, be it gasoline, propane, diesel fuel. It's not a filter, it contains no metals, magnets, or toxic substances, and uses no electricity. The GasMojo.net engine booster unit is a specially designed tube containing a completely safe proprietary media. It's a passive fuel treatment process designed to disperse hydrocarbons for better performance and mileage, and also to break down carbon and other contaminants. Unlock your fuel's hidden energy potential now with GasMojo.net. And folks, you get a 100% money-back guarantee on this. I've got one on my car. It was developed by an old friend of mine, and he's an honorable person. You got to try it, folks, and go open a bank account now for all the money you're going to save. GasMojo.net, GasMojo.net. Just do it.
Well, hello, everybody. This is the Saturday, June 12th version of Prophecy Keepers Radio, coming to you from the mysterious Missouri Ozarks and Booger County. This is your old buddy, Bluewater. And we're honored to have as our guest on this interview, Earth Thunder. Was born in Idaho. She grew up in a hunter-gatherer setting. Her people had left the southeast prior to the Cherokee removal in the 1830s. It did quite a bit of the nation, about a quarter of the nation removed in the 1700s following Dangerous Man. They went to the base of the Rocky Mountains near what is now Zaragoza, Coahuila, Mexico. And the traditional elements pulled out in the late 1700s, and left and went to what is now Arkansas and Missouri. And Earth Thunder's people went to Idaho, and she was, well, at that point, let me just introduce you, and you can go ahead and tell your story, sister.
Gratitude. I am Earth Thunder, and I like to speak out from my family's place of teaching that I do not speak for my reservation and I do not speak for other Native American people. I think it's important that I remind myself that the only one I can speak for is myself and my own experiences. And that's a very tender place in the world in these times, because it's very easy for me to see dilemmas in the world and want to make a statement of, you know, Native Americans should do this or Native American believes that. And it takes a lot of practice for me, and so this is a good time for me while I speak to our families out there in the airwaves to say I speak for myself and I speak for how my families personally lived and my own experiences as best as I can remember them. And I have a wonderful, dramatic life. I was very lucky to be born and raised in paradise for the first 11 years of my life. Even though tragedy came to my families quite often, there was that 10, 11 year period where it was really maybe like it might have been, say, 200, 300, 400 years ago. And my grandfather kind of set the smoke into the clouds by having a dream that was passed on by his father and his father's father. And the dream was that the elder men in the two elk clans were to be the keepers of what's called Lost River. And as I've been an adult and I've studied maps and geography and different ways that things were named, during my grandfather's days, the actual Lost River Range had not been named yet. So I just kind of smile and twinkle at these little mysteries of dream work that come to different ones of us, and I think it comes to everyone. But in my grandfather and great-grandfather and great-great-grandfather, I mean, it was something that was their whole day, their whole life. And so my grandfather, very typical of many of the Cherokee men in our family, if they were, if there was a need anywhere in the United States or the world for a strong man to be in line, they would come steal my grandfather and steal my great-grandfather and take him off, ship him off somewhere to do mining. And about probably 1920s, I guess, by some good luck, my grandfather and great-grandfather ended up kind of loose in Biloxi, Mississippi. In other words, no one had seized them or indentured them. And it had been a long, long time since my grandfather and his grandfather, his father, had seen their immediate family. It had been probably several decades. And they had no idea if they were alive or if they also had, you know, when you're indentured, quite often you're indentured for several different things and then you're murdered, so the life can be quite short. And so anyway, they're in Biloxi, Mississippi, and my grandfather, by the way, is also a twin, and he gets to Biloxi, Mississippi, and he's not really had a woman in his life through all of his years, and I'm suspecting he's getting about midlife, and he meets my grandmother, and as we say in our Cherokee way, there was a thunderbolt that caused the ocean to shrink all the way to the tip of Cape Horn. And I must say my grandparents were probably the most erotic two human beings I've ever known in my entire life. And so that thunderbolt must have been quite a long song. But they met, and it comes to be that my grandmother is also a twin, and she's also been indentured for many decades of her life. And not long after their thunderbolt, they meet and do their marriage, lo and behold, here comes their twins at different sequences of time, but in a short period of time. And there wasn't quite the thunderbolt between them, my grandfather's brother and my grandmother's sister, but they found a joy that certainly was welcome to this journey that my grandfather was about to embark everyone on. And so they married, and then it was like ants coming out of a very old anthill. Here comes cousins, here comes other elders of our society, our band. And all had heard, either in dream or in conversations through the reservation or through different travels, or like I say, this indentured piece, of my grandfather's responsibilities to the Lost River. So they all gathered and started making plans, and I think it took them some 10 years to come across the United States, headed in the direction of Idaho. And I don't, from what I gathered in my young years, neither my grandfather or my grandmother had ever been to the Rocky Mountains. They were not familiar with how to get there, and didn't really, other than knowing a passage of people who had been there and so forth. It was really quite a blind eye journey. And so they made all these stops and places and finally do come to what's called Mackay, Idaho, which is at the base of the Lost River Range. And that's where their first camps were set place. And it was a very, it would be even today, would be very precarious to be in Mackay, Idaho and be a Native American tribe. And it's not to say anything negative about Mackay, Idaho. It is the standard shrinking ranching community, and was in those days as well, wherein they had already wiped the earth clean of wolves and grizzly, and all of our clans that are indigenous to my family. And anyone who would speak of being a wolf or grizzly clan or whatever, of course, was seen as an enemy or a burglar. And so I'm sure it was very dangerous to be there at that time. And so being a nomadic society, a nomadic band, and just by the sake of wanting to stay alive, my family moved quite a bit. And so they moved from different places of the Lost River Range up through the area called the River of No Return. And finally ended up, about the time I came into life, in a place called Fairfield, Idaho, or the Smoky Mountain Basin. And I do not think that my grandparents had more than one child, who was my mother. If they did, they never spoke of having other children. And that's kind of typical, though. I mean, if a child dies, you wail for 2 years, and then you wail no more, because you don't want to interrupt their passage. And so my mother was living by the time they got to Smoky Basin, but she was stolen about 15, so I was told, and brought down to be indentured by a Mormon family. And it's very illegal in those days for a Native American woman to get pregnant if she were indentured in that particular community setting. I don't know about everywhere, but in that particular area. So she had connected with my father, who was a Cherokee returning from World War II, Korean War, and began to show her pregnancy. And it is said by the local sheriff at that time, who became quite a long-term friend of mine as I was to grow up, that they murdered my father for his act of bringing child to my mother. And then they didn't quite catch her in time. She did birth me, because usually they will kill you first. But they did kill her upon my birth and took me to a place by a railroad track and stuck me apparently under a staircase in this abandoned shack. And the sheriff really didn't want to buck the system of who had done this. But he had an idea where my grandparents were up on the basin, which would have been maybe 9,000 feet up on the mountain. And so he made the journey up and told them about this baby, which was me. And so they came down and got me. And I obviously lived. And I got to spend my very beginning days in this amazingly remote place that in the summer we would live at about 9,000 feet, totally in the old way with the mud lodge where a lot of the grasses and herbs would grow out of the mud during the summer. Then we would let go of the lodge and we would travel down the mountain across the prairie and into the canyons, and we would stay in caves during the winter. And it's a Fairfield, Idaho, quite often in the Rocky Mountains is the coldest place in the Rocky Mountains during the winter. And yet, it just shows what happens when you're in family and family is well, and you're really in the place of your life work. I only remember a couple of winters that I was cold. All I really remember, and very effectively remember, is that we were constantly doing our work. We were constantly doing what was guided. We were in ritual every day. And it was a really wonderful early life because from my perspective and my experience, I really didn't think there was anyone else on the planet but us. And a few people we'd see come through camp or we would pass as we go across the prairie. So what a nice way to begin life, thinking that you and your wonderful family kind of own the whole planet. And so I have many wonderful hours and weeks and years of those early days of teaching of how humans have their place on this planet, and that this planet will always be the most intelligent, and it is for the humans to find ways to clear themselves, humble themselves, and keep their nose in front of them so that they can learn from the wisdom and the intelligence of this planet. And I don't ever remember a raised voice. There was certainly no anger. We worked way too hard, and we had too many survival needs to have the kind of self-massaging time to get into an argument or to feel jealousy or to get into control and all those kinds of things. And so I really honor and just am in awe that I had that, just, you know, one of those kind of little crosses in the energy of space and time to be born to my family, and that they are and have been who they are. And then comes a time when lessons and the way things are on this planet came to change. And I think I was, you know, I don't have a birth certificate that is legal in that way. I was given one later, but I was probably 10 or 11 years old, and something had happened on one of my grandfather's jaunts out, and he came back and became very hot, very much of a temperature, and he died. And just before he died, he had set upon for me to do my first Sundance. And in our family, we don't call it Sundance. We have another series of language, which is a secret language for us that we call it. But he was quite a wisdom teacher in what people would be more familiar with call it Sundance, even though now Lakota is really their name, their words. But I had, at about age 10, for my rite of passage, had participated in my first Sundance and the piercing and dragging of the sacred tree. And for what I understood of those times, if the dance had been complete and in honor, then it would offer my people more life. And if there wasn't a completeness or an honoring, then my people would die. And, you know, I can tell my story 100 times to tens of thousands of people and not a tear will fall. But that's when it's my story and it appears to not have some difference. So I did with what is known within the heart to do with my dance. And a few months after my dance, my grandfather dies. And death is not looked upon as a terrible thing. It's looked at, actually, as quite an amazing amazing, quite awakening. But I have that stigma, you know, that all of us do, of wanting to do it right. And I think it still kind of kicks me in the butt even today of how much I get tied up in wanting to do something right so that I'll have an outcome. Well, it went on. My grandfather died, and about a year later, we were on this very high mountain place, very remote, no roads, no logging had really been done in the area where we were at, so it was really quite profound that anyone would come in with any kind of equipment, certainly nothing automated.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Hi, friends. This is Blue Water. Ayurvedic medicine is also called Ayurveda. It's a system of medicine that originated in India several thousand years ago. The term Ayurveda combines two Sanskrit words, Ayur, which means life, and Veda, which means science or knowledge. Ayurveda means the science of life. Ayurveda is a whole medical system which integrates and balances the body, mind, and spirit. Thus, it's considered holistic. This balance is necessary for contentment and good health. While pharmaceutical companies extract active ingredients from plants and sell them as drugs, the benefits of medicinal plants cannot be replicated because their synergistic combination of hundreds of naturally occurring phytochemicals cannot be reproduced in laboratories. This fact has been known to Ayurveda for thousands of years. The benefit comes from using the whole plant, not just the isolated ingredient. Because they contain whole herbs and fruits, Ayurvedic formulas are safer and more effective as opposed to Western formulations, which oftentimes have harmful side effects. We satisfy the health needs of our customers through safe, well-researched, and effective Ayurveda-based remedies using premier quality herbal extracts and sound manufacturing practices. We believe in Ayurveda so much, we're willing to offer you a 110% money-back guarantee. So be sure and visit india-herbs.us today and find out what this is all about.
And I'll never forget standing and doing some things that I was doing, and everyone was pretty much gathered at camp. And we hear this noise, this grinding noise that came from long way and got closer and closer. And here appeared this huge mechanical thing that had big old ski tracks on it. And I've since now discovered what it was. The big tractor that goes up the hill in the mountain during snow time that packs the snow down on those big treads. Well, it was coming up through the trees, and it was pulling behind it a kind of an old-time backhoe, and I thought it was just a gigantic grasshopper, and I was very interested to go over and once it finally got into sight and see how a grasshopper could possibly grow that big. But there were men inside of both of these machines. One was standing behind, several men were on the flatbed pulling this backhoe, and there were a couple of men in the tractor. So they get out, and they come over to the men in our circle, and there was some loud words, and it was like an explosion of lightning. All I can remember is that there were noises that I had never heard. I had never heard a rifle or a pistol. We were very, very, very much in the most remote of tools, making tools from the flint, the obsidian, the granite, making different things from the trees. And so all of these noises started happening, and there was a knowing that something that I could not imagine would happen. And my people started falling to the earth, and they were bloodied, and they had been murdered. And I was grabbed by the hair, and I was pushed into this big monstrous tractor with what I later learned was their language, saying that they thought I'd been stolen, because I am fairly light, and that I must have been stolen from a Mormon family, and they had to save me from these red dogs. And so I remember sitting in this thing, looking at a way of life, and the power of dreams, down the edge of the earth from some unknown anger and disgust that had come from these people with their boulders of lightning. And then I have kind of like an amnesia. I don't even remember kind of where they took me or what really happened. All I know is that eventually I ended up being in an orphanage in Boise, Idaho. And everything that I could possibly imagine that was reality for me came to a very, very, very cold closure. And I say that now, still in such mystery, because in everything that I had experienced and anything that is my family's way, even in death, I would have had, it, or should have had, the big should word, should have had voices, should have had connection to all of my family members, whether they were dead or alive. I mean, that happens always. You have total communication that's ongoing. But from the last smell of the smoke of these guns, there was silence. Not a word, not a movement from my grandmother. Not a whisper, not a wind breath from my grandfather, or my great-grandfather, or my cousins, or my aunts and uncles. And I was certain for probably the remaining, the next 20, not remaining, but the next 20 years, that I had failed in my Sundance. I had killed them. And to say the least, I became quite psychotic over having that belief. And being in the orphanage, I was adopted twice, and since I was a very big woman, I'm a buffalo woman, I'm a wolf woman, and very strong and very, what do they call that? Macro. I can do many things at the same time.
Uh-huh.
And many people thought that that would be good. I could do many jobs. But I had the old way. I was raised in the wild, so I would go, you know, out and find some, I mean, in city, all you've got is mostly dog poop, so I would rub with the dog poop and I'd go roll in the dirt so I wouldn't get bit by flies. And then that was very unpleasant to the people who had adopted me. So I was kicked back to the orphanage pretty fast. And I didn't do well on the food because I'd never eaten. I had not even seen a fork. I had not seen any of the kinds of ways that they ate. And I was always going out and trying to get berries and dig some roots and, you know, and chew on some bark and blah, 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 and, you know, grab a squirrel. And that was very unpleasant to them. So I was beaten a lot.
So you're saying, based on what they would say today, they would call you a feral child, literally.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They were certain that I was some sort of monster that had come out from under some horrible nightmare, you know, child bed is a nightmare. And so I was very scary to them, and they tried plugging me into school. And I had never been to school, I'd never seen a pencil, and I like to tell people, if you ever want to see from what maybe the wild looks at humans and wonders, what are you doing? You know, my perspective is being raised in the wild, like the animals and the bugs and snakes and everything. They put me into school, and first of all, I see this building, and that, of course, you know, like the orphanage, just, I thought, that's just so ridiculous, because it wasn't in a box floor with no air, you know. And it was very hard for me to consider being in there. And then I saw everybody with these pencils, and I was positive that there must be humans on the earth that were born with all these extra fingers, and they would cut them off so they could write with them. So I was beaten quite often because I would tie my hands behind me, and you couldn't beat me to make me untie my hands, because I was sure you were going to take one of my fingers and make it into a damn pencil. And, so I, soon, though, I got to the place of having a little more understanding of what that pencil was for, and mostly that was because I understood books. I mean, when I saw books, that was one thing that crossed all lines of needing to understand why and what and everything. I could already hear the voices coming from books. And then when I watched the students and the teacher read the books, and then they would write with the pencil. I thought, oh, they just done a special arrangement with the tree people where those books are singing a song, and they're catching the song with their pencils, and they're, you know, extending the stories, just like stories are to be extended. And so I, after a while, settled down. I was adopted, finally, to have the tragedy go on to a family that I have found in my adult life did murder two of their older children and needed to have someone to replace them so that it wouldn't be noticed that these two children were gone. And both of these two people ended up to be the scariest, most notorious human beings I've ever met in my life, probably even more than who murdered my own personal family. And I'm writing several books that I am sure will equal Stephen King in unbelievable terror. But I lucked out in that I must have really set him over the edge in the short time I was with him, because had me swallow razor blades, you know, beat me.
Yeah.
Did unbelievable things sexually, for which I ended up with years and years and years and years of surgery. But I did manage to go into a coma where it looked like I was dead, so they just dumped me. And this wonderful street cop found me in Boise by the name of Bisterfeld, who has since become quite important politically over the years. But he, like, picked me up, took me into a hospital and sat with me and just kept... I remember hearing this white word called invincible. And he kept saying, Running Wolf, and which is my birth song, Running Wolf, you are invincible, and I'm in this coma, and all I could hear is a strange language, you know, my name, but this invincible word. And I came out of it, and he then took me before a judge, and pretty much to my knowledge, in Idaho, I was the first juvenile emancipation in Idaho. And even though it was pretty squirrely in those days, because you couldn't tell anyone that you were emancipated, you had to not have anyone ever know where you lived, and you had to get straight A's in school. Well, I didn't start school until I was like 11 years old, so that was...
Had to get straight A's?
Straight A's. You had to get a 4-point, or you were bounced right back to the last family that had either foster care or adopted you, and these would be these monster people.
Oh, you're kidding.
Oh, yeah, it was bizarre. And they gave you no social help, you know, there was no money, no rent, no food stamps, no nothing. And if you ever even looked like you were breaking the law, I mean, it was, you know, I mean, the judge was very, very clear. This is not something that we can let any of these other kids think is something they might have an option to. So here I come from my family being killed at an orphanage, and I'm getting adopted to the worst monsters on the planet. And then I get this freedom that really, until I get out of school, is not freedom. I can't have a single friend because nobody there knows that I am living by myself, supporting. I'm eating out of dumpsters. You know, I'm trying really, really hard not to do anything that will appear illegal. I'm still trying to come up with $50, you know, earning $50 somewhere for rent. But I did make it. There's something about wolves that I do believe that they're spirit gatekeepers. I mean, you can kill us, but we'll never totally go away. And so I went from Bisterfeld, as my kind of first white knight on a white horse type guy, to there's a newspaper in Idaho called the Idaho Statesman, and one of their more famous editors is called Sandra Klein, and he had retired to Idaho and then decided to take on the Statesman. Anyway, as I was eating in a dumpster behind a restaurant where he was eating, he comes out and he said, what are you doing, you know? And I started to run away because I thought, oh, shit, man, I'm going in trouble now. And he said, no, wait a minute. He said, you're the kid they didn't tell me about. He said, I need to talk to you. And so over many times of kind of running into him and little conversations, he was so insightful to read between the lines and hear. And he said, you know what? He said, you're at war. And he said, there, I could tell by how you look, how you, you know, just your energy, that there is something else that you're here to do, and I need some help from somebody who's as wild as you. And so, I'm like not really understanding where he's going with that. But he ended up being an amazing tutor. I managed to study and learn the language, and I did graduate with straight A's.
Howard.
In between all of that, he ended up taking me. My first trip out of Idaho was to San Francisco, and we set in a big hotel and with these people, and this very, very warm, rich Afro-American man sat beside me, and he said, well, Sandy here says that you're quite an unusual woman, and I didn't really understand what that meant.
By this time, you're about how old?
About 16. 16 was the first trip out of Idaho. And I was still in school. It was a summer vacation, and I was working for the state to earn money and all of that. But anyway, Sandy took me to San Francisco to this meeting. And Sandy says to this man, he said, well, one of the things I know about Running Wolf is whatever she decides that she's going to get something going as a statesman, I mean, she can get like 30, 40, 50 people like on a staff, you know. She can talk people into doing things. It's just amazing that they wouldn't even ask questions why they're doing it. And so this gentleman on the other side, he says, well, what I need is someone to help me organize people to have rallies and do some things that are rather activist. I know those words now, but I'm sure I didn't understand them then. And who I was sitting by was Dr. Martin Luther King.
Oh, you're kidding.
I'm not.
I had his son in 72.
Yeah. And so from that place.
And this was what year, by the way? 57?
Yeah, it was 57 was when my family was murdered. And so I would have been, like I said, so it would have been a space of maybe 4 years, 5 years, so what's that, adding that up, so we're getting into
so that's when the loggers, so yeah. Your grandparents, but I guess your mother and father were actually killed earlier, 51.
Yes, they were. Yeah, and to this day, I'm really not positive. I would never lay any kind of claim to know who murdered my people. I suspect it was over a mine that was active, and they had probably tried to come get the men from our tribe and force them into working at this mine. And because it was getting close to winter, and because it was at the end of summer when this happened, that they had probably got to try to come and work, and we needed to get off the mountain and get across the prairie and get into the canyon so we wouldn't be caught in snow. And they were probably just trying to show them that they could not, you know, they dare not say no to them. And from ranchers that I've interviewed through my life and different newspaper things that I've read, that's where I come to think that it was probably about mining. It could just as well have been about logging. It could have just as well been. There was a series of articles written in a newspaper in Haley in about, 1955, 54, where this real, just awful, awful, awful general had retired from somewhere in the Midwest, had retired to Sun Valley, Haley area, and had written many articles stating that he had smelled that there were some red dogs in the area and that he was going to take care of all the women and children by making sure that the eradication of these red dogs would be equally successful as wolves and grizzlies, and that he was going to take his place in the community by making sure everyone would be safe.
And this was the 1950s, and they're exterminating Indians.
Yeah.
Well, not to interrupt and keep your point there, but I do want to interject here that this is really, really bad karma for Mormons to be doing this, or people that even live near Mormons. You know, not everybody that's in Idaho is Mormons, but...
No, and there are a lot of really wonderful people. There's nothing wrong with the religion of Mormonism. There's just a lot of people who claim to be Mormons who are really psychotic.
Oh, yeah.
You know, also.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, they're, you know, their teachings, you know, Brigham Young, you know, when they first got out to Utah, he instructed quite a few of them to intermarry with Indians.
Absolutely.
And a lot of people don't realize that the Mountain Meadows Massacre, the people, there's actually two groups. One group was the Fancher Party from Harrison, Arkansas, and as they passed through Kansas City, there were some people that insinuated themselves on their wagon train that had been involved in depredations against the Mormons when they were in Missouri. And as they passed through the Green River Country and into Salt Lake, they were boasting that they had done acts of raping and murder against the the Mormons, and you know, they were, I guess they were known as Red Legs, you know, bad dudes. But anyway, I guess, you know, the Telegraph was ahead of them, and this company made some arrangements because there were, I guess as the story goes, there were white men dressed up as Ute Indians that massacred these people. But, you know, and it was a similar situation where the children were taken alive and absorbed in the community. I guess there were some Indians that were involved and some white people, but I guess the story that John Lee told was that the Mormon men were not allowed to kill any of the women, so they let the Indians that were among them kill the women.
I'll see you.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Hi, this is Will Bluehour speaking on behalf of Native Remedies. As the systems of the body are interrelated, proper functioning and health occurs when they are in balance and harmony, so it's important to consider taking a holistic approach to caring for your body. Provided that they are manufactured in the correct way, natural medicines can work quickly and safely to create holistic balance in the body to support systemic health, relieve ailments, and help prevent future disease. Most natural remedies do not produce negative side effects, and unlike conventional medicine, natural remedies do not just mask symptoms, but they get to the root of the problem to support health and affect healing at the same time. Most homeopathics are even safely taken by people of all ages and during pregnancy. Homeopathic medicine is actually suppressed here in the United States. Outside of this country, a large majority of medicines that are prescribed are homeopathics. Did you know that the cure for malaria was developed by the man that invented the homeopathic system? That's right. So friends, please take my advice. Visit the front page of prophecykeepers.com and click on the Native Remedies banner and find out what all the excitement's all about.
Because the Mormon men figured that they would be shedding innocent blood. You know, they had a lot of weird beliefs back in those days, and just a lot of, you know, because they melded their religion with masonry, really, and they caused some problems. But anyway, you know, they ended up massacring mixed-blood Cherokees, and, you know, if there was a nation that fitted the description of the prophecy in the Book of Mormon that talks about the a people that would become, well, the Book of Mormon says, you know, calls the people that would be Indians, call them Lamanites, but they said that if there were any descendants of the other group of people, the Book of Mormon people were Nephites. These are two factions, and they swap back and forth as to their position on their religion and several times, but it came down to 1,500 years ago, a major battle, and, you know, basically everybody was killed or scattered, and if there were any of the Nephites left, that they would become like Ed Lamanites. And, but, you know, if there was a group of people that, that possibly may have been a remnant of these people, you know, it would be the Cherokees, but, you know, and nobody can really figure it out because there's no written history, but there are literally dozens and dozens of similarities between Cherokee language, religion, culture, and so forth, and that of Hebrew peoples. But it could also be accounted for because the Hebrew people and the Cherokee people may have had the same beginnings in Samaria, because the Cherokee people always had to have an outlet to the sea. The skeletons that ethnologists and archaeologists have discovered in Cherokee graveyards all the way from Alabama to Pennsylvania are the Egyptian dolichocephalic or long-headed skulls. The only place you find those is in coastal areas all around the world where the Mauritanian or Phoenician peoples had gone. And also in the Appalachian mountain chain surrounded by the round-headed Indians that didn't have the long skull. So the Cherokees are different. They had a different language, a different culture, and Atakulakula, in a ritual message to the nation in 1750, announced, well, told the old story that we came from across the Eastern Ocean, you know, before the Stone Age man, and, you know, several thousand years before. And, you know, so we may, and the Phoenician people were obviously plying the oceans 4,000 years ago, because otherwise the Piri Reis's map of 500 years ago, which showed the perfect topography of Antarctica, which wasn't known until the early 80s because the technology wasn't available to them. But the Phoenicians knew the oceans, and they were called red men, and they wore special red clothing, and so, you know, the Cherokee may have been the descendants of these people, and we always insist on having an outlet to the sea, and so that may account for, personally I subscribe to the theory that that we had a, rather than being descendants of lost Israel, that we all had a similar beginning in Sumeria, possibly. And, you know, a lot of Indian people, you know, say, oh, you're crazy, we're always over here. Well, you know, the Chickasaw, they say they came from across the Eastern Ocean. There's a lot of people that say they didn't originate here. And, but anyway, you know, there's prophecy in the Book of Mormon that says that, you know, in the latter days, that there would be a group of people, and the Cherokees do roughly fit a position that might fulfill that prophecy. And but anciently, the Cherokee and the Hopi were known as the Twin Fires. And you know, if we spoke, you know, everybody shut up and listen. So anyway, it's just a little, you know, that's the reason why I brought up the whole Mormon thing, was if these were Mormons or people that claim Mormon background, and they killed your people, I mean, they were killing the very people that the book of, that may have written the Book of Mormon.
Yeah. Well, it was certainly an extensive, I mean, for anything that I've read or studied over my life, and I went on in my adult life to not only do the activism and really be part of the whole 60s, you know, I mean, almost to the point of getting myself thrown in prison with my activism. But then got a degree in psychotherapy and worked in prisons and have worked, you know, anything to do with behavioral change. Anthropology is just absolutely my passion, to try to make sense of all this. And so that at least being the one who was left living, I could find ways to understand it, so perhaps we can learn how not to keep repeating this. But the extensiveness of what these people did to take us out, for as remote as we were, had to be driven by something other than money, other than just, you know, someone was ticked off. It was very, very deep, and you know, I think there has to be something there with some sort of righteous persecution that made them, you know, like the sheriffs of today, you know.
Yeah.
That there's that the depth and longevity of fear and you know, just that bizarreness that out of their fear that if they can just keep eradicating and genociding, that will you know, ease their fear. And that certainly became an experience. But my place that I, you know, I usually tell my story because it's long enough and I'm healed enough that it is my story. And a lot of, like it always says in anyone's life who's had a lot of tragedies, it's the early university training for what you're to become in your adult life, and get on, get your butt in gear, and get your work done, you know. And so I speak and ask in whatever ways that can be held, that one of the things that came from that healed myself, besides really getting busy and getting out there working among people for freedom and the rights of people, and the healing of behaviors, is that the dream, which is exactly how I got to come into the world because of my grandfather's dream is the place that is the most powerful, and it seems to be that there aren't any religions or laws yet that will come kill you because you dream. So if I had a message that I speak to myself and I live, and every day I make sure that every day has the health, has the timing, has the planning, then I can make sure I dream and I listen. And then I do whatever I can to put what I have dreamed into actual reality around me, in my language, in my behavior, in my health, in my relationships. And I guess people often ask me, how did you ever recover from that? And, you know, when you study psychotherapy and all of that, they say you will never recover. Well, either I'm taking it real well or I have been able to transform it. And the dream has been one of the major parts of that transformation. And so I give that out to our friends and families who are listening tonight, and just suggest highly that the very wealth that every human has is your dream, and you get to sleep every night, which is where you heal, and where if you heal enough, you will dream. And if you activate your dream during the day, I know from my own life, life within you and life around you will change. And among all of us, I put myself no better or no worse than anyone who's done anything that's been done to me. We just have an awful lot of human beings in the world with an awful lot of time that's gone by without being a strong community. And so that would be the second place, is that I have, through my adult life, made sure that a good deal of my work and time and focus has been spent in creating community. And communities, they're working communities, not just communities that like each other. And we practice a universal global dreaming. And so it takes a lot of patience to stay on the planet and stay in the dilemmas that we are.
From what I've seen, what you're saying is really the only way out, because you know, one of the e-books that I wrote, it's called All Things Common, and it talks about the ancient life way. But if you look at it from the perspective of Eastern Hemisphere people, I mean, those people were told, look, if you're rich, go sell everything. If you're poor, come join us. You know, bring your talents. But we're going to live in one place. We're going to establish a storehouse. We're going to bring our offerings and tithes into it. We're going to, you know, we're going to share a meal a day there. You know, we're going to do things communally. We're going to butcher. We're going to cook. We're going to weave. You know, we'll have our own families, houses, and so forth and so on. And, you know, you'll have our own possessions. But basically, we're, you know, the women are going to be in charge of the homes and the fields, and the men in charge of outside affairs and hunting and so forth and so on. But this, it didn't matter whether it was Eastern or Western Hemisphere, this was kind of the story. But this is what Jesus taught. And for, you know, I guess about 50 years after his death, this is the way that the Christians lived. And it was so sacred that the story of Ananias and Sapphira, but they weren't really clear about what happened, but they were rich people that had some property, and they entered into this all things common life way. And you remember Jesus, you know, telling the rich man, he was asked, well, how do I, you know, get to heaven? He says, go sell everything you have. Give it to the poor. So Ananias and Sapphira sold their land, and instead of giving it all to the apostles like they promised, they lied. And long story made short, one by one, as they lied, they dropped dead on the spot. And, you know, the other story in the Book of Mormon is that there was the five generations, I guess it was 200 and some odd years, that the people, after Christ visited the people over here, and there's, you know, the stories of the pale, you know, bearded God, you know, even as late as 1930 visiting the Tana Islanders, it's just, you know, we'll look at it. Everybody, all the tribes talk about him. The Creton, with Sacajack, he's got a million different names. The Cherokee people, he came to us a long time ago, but or somebody fitting that description. But the whole idea of community and all things common, and you know, from the Eastern Hemisphere standpoint, the promise is that if you live that way, that you would be fed like stall-fed calves and protected and hidden. You know, a lot of people wondered, well, how the Indians, you know, they could just disappear, and they seem to have to be protected, and You know, it's said in the latter days there won't be any place to hide, but this is, it would be a place to hide. It's worked before, and community is going to be the answer. Edgar Casey talked about it. Scallions talked about all the seers of the book, your Rasher book. They all say that this is the only way we're going to be able to preserve civilization after what is going to happen happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly in my experience so far, limited as it is, been the only thing that I could actually feel that I could tell the truth about, that it has an ongoing, perpetual movement that helps humans not be so tied up and worried about being a who, rather they're willing to walk away. You know, they're willing to work and move and be a movement of a way or ways, rather than stand in that robotic way, which many of, especially in our, you know, commercialized areas, everyone's so individual and so robotic and so consumed with being a who. And to me, that's like taking a drug of death. It's a very slow death. Where when you're in community, there's not enough time. You know, it's not set up to have that kind of distraction where you're just absorbed in being, who am I? You're really proactive in regard to working and fulfilling and just moving without it being anything that ends up being any accumulation of anything. So as you look back at the land that we live on as communities and the way our health works in communities and so forth, it does seem to be the kind of energy that matches this planet. And so certainly works for us.
Oh, and that was the faith that Columbus found the people in. He called them people in God, you know, Ian Dios. Indian Abram.
Well, gosh, Luana, this has been so nice to spend some time with you and all. I just am very honored to have this time. You've been a really wonderful satellite in my life. You've had just great timing. We'll have spaces of time we won't touch, and then just exactly when I need you, you're right there. So
yeah.
I truly, more than just the word brother, consider you my brother. And,
I wish I would have met you when, yeah, I didn't meet Rolling Thunder until, 92 maybe, something like that. And
mm-hmm.
I understand, you know, you spent a lot of time with him. And,
yes.
And I guess he even let you doctor him one time.
Well, I have a story. I'll make that my
title. All the time you want.
Okay, rather than using this all the time, but that'll be my story. And then I've been having a little laryngitis, so I'm not going to talk too long tonight. But,
okay.
I haven't seen Rolling Thunder for some time, as is normal. In the work among elders and the work among medicine women and medicine men and shaman way and so forth, you know, there's no schedule about when to get together. You just get together when it's really supposed to be, and you're right where you're supposed to be. But I was very busy doing something, and phone rings, and I hear this telephone operator say, you are to be in Carmel, Nevada in 2 days. So I called back to get a hold of Rolling Thunder to see what was going on and why a telephone operator would call me. And the phone was out at the camp, at the Meditante. And so I couldn't get a hold of anyone. And then I hung up the phone, and the phone rings again, and the telephone operator and said, instead of 2 days, we need you there in 1 day. And I said, who is this? And I said, well, it's whoever it was, the telephone company, this is the operator. And I said, well, how did you know to get a hold of me? And they just said, I know. You know, didn't know. It's one of these, like, phone rings and it's talking on its own. So I get in my vehicle, my iron pony, and I take off during the night to head down to Rolling Thunder's. And often I could go directly to Rolling Thunder's, and then it just seemed like this was one of these times where I better stop at the cafe in Carlin and wait to see what I was to do next, not just go directly to the camp. And so I had gotten there. I was there for a couple hours or something, and up drives a woman in a station wagon, and she said, it's good that you waited. We need to take you out to Meditante, not over to the actual in-town place where Rolling Thunder also stayed. So they took me out to the Meditante, and at this particular time, it was pretty much a ghost area, because, you know, Roman Thunder's wife had crossed, and there was that time for him where he'd gone into an underground cave and was having great difficulty. And so I stayed out there all by myself for a couple of nights, and then finally here comes the woman again in the station wagon, and she said, well, he's ready to see you now. So then I get in the station wagon with her and go back into town and go into the famous kitchen, where in Rolling Thunder's home, you had to kind of pile up in the kitchen, and you weren't allowed to go past the blanket until he screamed for you.
I'll see you.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Friends, this is Will Bluewater speaking on behalf of WiseFoods.org. Our native ancestors stored away lots of food in case of emergencies. Thousands of years of sad experience taught them to be prepared. The traditional Hopi stored food enough to last for 7 years. So did the early Mormons. Nowadays, everyone unwisely depends on supermarkets for their food supply, and few people know that there is only a 3-day supply of food in the American food supply chain. Now, should some disaster befall us that would cause the big trucks like I used to drive to cease delivering our food, you'd be in big trouble. It is for these reasons that my family purchased a year's supply of 3 different breakfast and 10 delicious dinner entrees from WiseFoods.org. These foods are freeze-dried right at the field where they are picked and processed, and are fresher and more nutritious than any supermarket food. You just add hot water, and they're good for 25 years being stored. A year's supply from WiseFoods.org fits in an area about 4.5 feet by 4 feet by 18 inches. I can literally get it all in the back seat area of my Honda Civic. If you stay at home, you won't need to go to a FEMA refugee center should some disaster happen. Did you know that David Ramsey, David Gallagher, Laura Ingram, and Michael Medved have also invested in Wise Foods? Why don't you visit wisefoods.org today and see why.
And that's a small kitchen, you know, 12 by 16 maybe,
you know, and there's a lot of other people generally there who want to see him or have been called by him or think they're called by him, or there are a lot of tourists who think that they found Carl and Adam, the famous Rolling Thunder, so that kitchen could really be wiped up. So finally I hear on the other side of the blanket he's yelling for Thunder, you know. And so I think then maybe then the other 2 days have passed. And so I go in and I was not prepared for what I was going to see, and I can't tell the whole story of what I saw other than just to hear in the depths of my conversation with you tonight that I couldn't have made up what I thought I would see, the state of his health and the state of his legs. And I was just very, very amazed that he was still alive. And I really thought then what I felt was that I had been called to help him. I am a death keeper, and I'm called often to help people cross over, and that's been the purpose of what this was going to be about. And instead he grabbed me, and he just sunk his hands into me, and he said, you will bring life to me. And I don't really know why. These things I could never, you know, I couldn't rationally explain it in any way, shape, or form, other than I knew exactly what I had to do and what he was instructing me to do, and yet a positive, you know, he only gave me maybe, you know, 4 words. And so I left, went out in the night, drove, got to a place, built a fire, didn't go to sleep, waited for sunrise, and then started walking toward the sun, toward grandfather. And I can't even say it's a day that I knew then exactly where I was at. And I came onto a place where some golden eagles flew up in the air, and I knew it was close to where I was supposed to be, and I went a little ways further, and some horrible poachers had caught, I think there were 4 coyotes in total, and had done the typical, to this day, Nevada way with coyotes. They shoot them in the ass so that they don't die right away, and then they use barbed wire to hang them on a fence so that they will die and slow death. And so here were the four coyotes screeching and just this horrible, chilling horror and terror that men do. And I took two of them, I took them all down and did the way the Cherokee do for death. And then I took the, cut their back legs, and I proceeded to get back to where Rolling Thunder was. And then, that's another part that I cannot speak of, but, for the most part, what we did was take the coyote legs and put them back into his legs. And for a period of almost a year, he was able to get in and out of his wheelchair, get in and out of bed. We were able to go back out to the land, and to the Natani, to the little people, to Sacred Mountain. And it was that capturing of time for him between where he had lived, and it wasn't too much longer from that that he did actually cross over. That he had the place to dance and be the coyote romance that is everything that Rolling Thunder was born to be and still is to this day. And it was one of those things that you can't explain what really happened. You know, did I actually just go cut off coyote legs and go through the process that he guided me to do? And or did we enter a dream? And just remember the time that he had coyote legs and he could dance and the coyote dance and their romance. It really doesn't matter. I had lots of confirmation that he didn't walk. I must go back too. He had amputation of his legs below the knee because of diabetes several years before this. And
I knew him when just his right leg was gone.
Yeah. And that was one of my many unexplainable experiences with Rolling Thunder, and being a student and then changing forms where you put me in a place to have to make some very major decisions. And my grandfather, I know my grandfather's hope. I can remember hearing him at the fires when I was 10. Talked to me that I would be a man who would be for me like my grandfather was to my grandmother, which would be my husband. And so I know my grandfather would have been very happy if I could have conjured my way into marrying Rolling Thunder.
Rolling Thunder probably would have been glad to have you.
Well, he actually made several requests of that nature. But at the time, I was very, very hard on men who had any women in their life, for which Rolling Thunder did often. And so I couldn't quite get my head turned around to the fact, you know, if you're going to have me, I will be the only woman. And that certainly wasn't a promise he never made and was not going to make. And, you know, and so we were very clear on what I needed and what he would do and what he needed. I just offered him the great promise to go find any woman who could offer him what he was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And but we really loved each other and cherished each other at a level that was truly a partnership, and he will be in my life forever. And I know he and my grandfather danced because they both could levitate and dance. I think they were both televised at some time, I was told, when I got to be an adult, that they were televised by one of the big networks. Doing their coyote dance, which means their feet do not touch the ground for about 3 minutes.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
I heard about that with John Lanza.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he was special. He really was. And, well, we don't want to keep you too long. I hope your voice is getting tired, and I don't know you have to save it. And but we sure appreciate you. I know it was hard telling your story, and I've never really heard the story either. We've corresponded since 98, and,
mm-hmm.
You know, I know what I've read, and you know, we've never really met back and forth about it, but I know where you came from and what you went through, and I know the horrendous post-traumatic stress syndrome that you were able to get over. and all that anger and in the 60s didn't help because I know you were associated closely with the encounters of AIM.
And, oh, yeah, very much.
But, you know, the Hopi elders called Elder Shaposh, who's a Chumash elder, and some years, about 10 years ago, and they said, you need to lose the word struggle from your vocabulary. And that's tough one for Indian folks to do because they love a good fight. And but we, our own worst enemies, and we really need to do what you're recommending that they do. But the problem is, as they look at they look, a lot of them look at you and laugh and say, "Oh, that's just a bunch of New Age nonsense." No, the New Agers got it from us. A lot of this stuff. So, and we've forgotten the dream. We have no Cherokees have in the Midwest and in the East haven't had a culture since 1880. And it's just starting to come back, and you're as we close here, I want to ask you, did you ever figure out that your Sundance wasn't from your grandparents and your immediate family there? It was for all of us Cherokees out here.
Yes, I did. And I've since done three more for which helped me through that, and really got that place, like you say, instead of it being about the tragedy and the struggle, it really becomes a transformation of sinless.
A lot of people will complain, "Oh, she's got to be a fake on a phony because, Sundance was a Cherokee way." But your people have been living out there, Chickamauga's Cherokees moved out onto the plains after, some of them joined up with Sioux and others. And, there was a lot of Cherokee affinity even up to the 60s and 70s with Cheyenne people.
Sure.
And I have to say that there's just too many coincidences between your story and Tom Berenger's movie Last of Dogman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and the many, many, many books that have been written that just about nail it down to within 100 acres of where I was raised.
The Oxbow.
Yeah. And there will come a time. I mean, I am very optimistic that, the 60s was kind of like an explosion. The 70s was robotic atrophy. But we start to build up again, and it doesn't have to be as dramatic as the 60s. It doesn't have to be as crazy, It actually is now what I feel, very consistent, stay under the radar, you leave a clean life, you build nice, healthy, strong, well communities, and our history will reveal itself.
In other words, the fires we build shouldn't be burning things down. They should be burning steadily in our backyards.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the warmth will bring the people to the circle, and they will tell their stories, and it won't be about who told the truth and who lied. It will be about the importance of the story being told and shared.
Hope.
And that's really all that matters. The hope.
Well, thank you for being with us. I know everybody is just going to be tickled to death to hear this interview. I know I was.
Well, I appreciate it very much.
Very, very expressive. You go rest your voice now.
Okay. Much good dreams to all.
Thank you.
Hope.
Thank you so much, sister, and good night, everybody out there. And I hope everybody has good dreams of a safe future. Hope.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases.
I'm Austin Powers. I like Gas Mojo. The very sexy and very switched on,
But you gotta have Gas Mojo, baby. Yeah!
What a gas, baby. Yeah!
I'm going to go back to the 60s and steal Austin Powers' Gas Mojo.
Hi, folks. This is Will Bluewater speaking on behalf of GasMojo.net Engine Booster. Immediate 25% fuel savings with GasMojo.net in just 5 minutes after installation. And your grandma can do it, so you just strap it on your fuel line, folks. Some customers report much greater savings. The GasMojo.net engine booster catalytically conditions any hydrocarbon fuel, be it gasoline, propane, diesel fuel. It's not a filter, it contains no metals, magnets, or toxic substances, and uses no electricity. The GasMojo.net engine booster unit is a specially designed tube containing a completely safe proprietary media. It's a passive fuel treatment process designed to disperse hydrocarbons for better performance and mileage, and also to break down carbon and other contaminants, Unlock your fuel's hidden energy potential now with GasMojo.net. And folks, you get a 100% money-back guarantee on this. I've got one on my car. It was developed by an old friend of mine, and he's an honorable person. You got to try it, folks, and go open a bank account now for all the money you're going to save. GasMojo.net, GasMojo.net. Just do it.
Let the truth be known to all mankind. the truth.